Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 13th. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a safe weekend, a happy Easter for those of you who celebrate Easter. Today is Monday for those of you who are losing track. Now, one of the calls we've been getting a lot from Democrats the last few weeks is a question, where's Joe Biden? And now that Bernie Sanders has suspended his presidential campaign, the question is even more relevant, right? Since Biden is the presumptive nominee. Well, here's a way that Joe Biden could begin to establish himself as much more of an alternative to President Trump. It comes from New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, whose latest column is headlined, What America Needs Next, A Biden Unity Cabinet. A Biden Unity Cabinet. It begins with three options for vice president, and we will take it from there. Hi, Tom. Welcome back, and thanks for coming on with us.
Brian, great to be with you. Are you broadcasting from the studio or home, or where are
no,
you?
No, no. I'm home.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, broadcasting from my dining alcove. Can't quite call it a dining room in my Manhattan apartment, but broadcasting
great.
From my dining alcove. How about you?
I'm in my Bethesda, Maryland home outside of D.C.
So before we get to any names or what kind of unity cabinet, and folks, Tom Friedman does name names, and we will name a lot of those names. Can you describe for us what you call the one giant contrast you say Biden would be trying to establish with this approach?
Yeah, and first of all, it's great to be back with you, Brian, and hope everyone there is staying safe and well. So I basically started with the following two points. I think that, you know, right now everyone is playing as nice as they can. We're all locked down at home. We're all in this together, you know, and thank God for that. But coming out of this crisis, there are going to be two wrenching issues, I think, that are going to explode. One is around equity. Who got bailed out and who didn't? And who got bailed out and took the money and run and ran and who didn't. There's just going to be huge fights and arguments over that because the economic pain of this crisis is going to be so much deeper and broader than even 2008. The second thing is that, pandemics only end in one of two ways. They either end because we get a vaccine or because we get herd immunity. That is about 60 to 70% of us get it, and the virus eventually burns out, but at a huge cost of death. And so what we're trying to have is a third option where we shelter in place, we suppress the virus, then we come out very gradually, we get back to work with certain restrictions. To do that third option, Brian, is going to require a lot of technology, the ability to trace, because people are going to want to know, just as after 9/11, they wanted to know the person sitting next to me on the airplane wasn't carrying a bomb, and now they're going to want to know the person next to me on the airplane isn't carrying COVID-19.
Right.
So the only way to do that is with technology, tracing, badging, licensing, et cetera. There's going to be a huge amount of civil liberties questions around that. So when you put these giant wrenching equity questions, who got bailed out, and these giant civil liberties questions, what technology will be allowed to determine who is a carrier and who is not, those are going to be such wrenching debates. I think only a national unity government will be able to manage them effectively. God forbid if we had Trump with his partisan instincts trying to manage those, and I think Democrats would be much more effective if they brought a national unity approach and contrast with Trump in that way.
And we'll get to some of the Republicans on this unity list, but first, for vice president, Biden has already committed to choosing a woman, and your short list includes three Democratic women, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Florida Congresswoman and former Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, or Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo. Want to compare and contrast a little bit?
Yeah, really I was looking for people who, and this is one of my sort of broad criteria of whoever you choose in this cabinet. Before I had a list of names, I had a list of criteria. And one of the criteria that there would be people who demonstrated leadership in this crisis. And that's why I chose those three. I mean, Raimondo, I think, has been very effective in Rhode Island. Whitmer, very effective in Michigan. And I threw in Donna Shalala because she had such experience both running the University of Miami and as the head of HHS. And so, don't take any of these names too seriously. I was not meaning to be sort of so exact, but more generic of the kind of people with the kind of skills I was looking for.
You then go on to recommend Michael Bloomberg as Treasury Secretary. Is that because Bloomberg could fund the Treasury himself?
Again, you know, there's a whole balance in this group between people who are from the progressive wing of the party and people who are from the conservative wing of the party, and everyone could play a role in the ecosystem, and so I chose Bloomberg or someone like him who could be seen as a credible person within the business community.
Then you go on to recommend Elizabeth Warren for a new position you call Secretary of Oversight for the trillions of dollars in emergency coronavirus spending. How do you see Elizabeth Warren's role in that new job?
Well, I think she's so smart about finance, and I think she's seen as uncorruptible that this may be the most important job in the next cabinet. You know, Brian, we've already spent about $2 trillion in kind of raw bailout money. We may spend a trillion more on that, and maybe, who knows, a trillion more on kind of infrastructure spending, sort of job creation, all of the kind of WPA or Rural Electrification Act in the Great Depression. Having someone like Elizabeth Warren oversee that, how is the money spent, where did it go, was the government paid back, who's cheating and stealing, hard to think of, for me, anyone more able to do that and more appropriate for that job.
Since this proposal for a unity government is for a unity government, you need Republicans. So, for example, you have Mitt Romney as Secretary of State and Ohio Governor Mike DeWine to head the Office of Management and Budget. Want to talk about your vision for Mitt Romney as Secretary of State, either in the context of the campaign or for actually doing the job?
Yeah, I mean, he's a global guy. I think he's a moderate Republican who could work with Democrats, and I think he showed a lot of personal courage in voting for impeachment. I think for all those reasons, he'd be the kind of Republican. You know, again, Brian, what happened after I wrote the column, it was so kind of funny. I mean, both in the comment section and then people just wrote me directly, said, loved your idea, but why him? Yeah. Loved your idea, but why her? It was great, but how could you say AOC or how could you say Mitt Romney? And right. So I just really tried to say to people, hey, make your own list, but this is simply, I'm speaking generically here. These are the kinds of people I think who could actually work together and hold the country together in a team of rivals under Joe Biden. So that,
I understand. And for people whose curiosity you just... by mentioning AOC, you put her on the list as UN ambassador. Also, Andrew Cuomo for Homeland Security Secretary, EPA Administrator, would be Al Gore, and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you raise, I think, the reason that no candidate in the past has done this. And you and I have heard this kind of call for nominees from either party to do it early on, you know, in times that weren't as intense as this year. Oh, why don't you name your vice president and your secretary of state and your treasury secretary and get this whole all-star team behind you and people will vote for this all-star team. But then, just like you've gotten emails and tweets and stuff that say, why him, why her, it creates an opportunity, but it also creates a whole list of other people, all of whom have their own controversies of one kind or another, for the opposition to shoot holes in, and then the media gets distracted by that instead of the bigger picture.
It's always a danger. Look, I will confess, it's no secret from my column. I think 4 more years of Donald Trump will just be a real disaster for the country. I think it would present systemic threat to our country. Do you realize what this guy did this morning? He retweeted a tweet by some fringe character calling for Dr. Fauci to be fired. I mean, think about that, Brian. In the middle of the pandemic, this guy retweeted to his 60 million followers someone calling for the firing of his top epidemic advisor. So, four more years of that, I think, is the most dangerous thing possible. So what I'm looking for is a coalition that can hive off maybe 10% of Republicans, maybe more, and bring them over to Joe Biden's side of the ledger and hopefully get him elected. So that's no secret. That's what I say in my column. And that is another of my ulterior motives here.
You know, I want to take a little closer look at what you mentioned, Trump retweeting this fringe Republican who tweeted #FireFauci. That, of course, refers to his science advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Infectious Diseases. The post that Trump retweeted was a reaction to Fauci saying this yesterday on CNN's State of the Union.
Obviously, you could logically say that if you had a process that was ongoing and you started mitigation earlier, you could have saved lives. Obviously, no one is going to deny that. But what goes into those kinds of decisions is complicated. But you're right. I mean, obviously, if we had, right from the very beginning, shut everything down, it may have been a little bit different. But there was a lot of pushback about shutting things down back then.
The tweet in response came from former California Republican congressional hopeful Deanna Lorraine. Lorraine only got 2% of the vote in a primary for Nancy Pelosi's House seat last month. Lorraine's tweet said, Fauci is now saying that had Trump listened to the medical experts earlier, he could have saved more lives. Fauci was telling people on February 29th, she asserts, that there was nothing to worry about and it posed no threat to the U.S. public at large. Time to fire Fauci. And Trump has now retweeted it. By the way, Tom, Trump's approval rating is 46% in the latest poll, and Fauci's is 78%. So do you think Trump is really setting up to fire Anthony Fauci or discredit Dr. Fauci or just trying to get a little rise from his base?
I think that the combination of the Washington Post TikTok look back on how we got into this, and now the New York Times one this week, which was incredibly comprehensive, and has rattled Trump. That he has he realized that his ability to whitewash all his behavior before this, his tendency to play it down and think that it would just miraculously go away, that that he's politically vulnerable there. My own feeling, Brian, is that thank God the Post and the Times and others are looking at that period. We need to understand that going forward for the purposes of history and the next pandemic. But what you really see in all the polls that kind of bounce around is that people who love Trump before love him after. People who love Trump, you know, hate Trump before, hate him after, that we are so dug into our tribal identities that the number of people, who will actually change their vote about Trump, based on his performance in this crisis, maybe it's 10% of the population. That said, the election could ride on that. And I think those people will be motivated to vote one way or another about Trump, depending not on what happened before we sort of went into lockdown, but what happened after? How well did he manage the lockdown period and the pivot back to opening the economy?
I heard that Fauci clip is not throwing Trump under the bus, by the way. He said there was pushback and closing the country is complicated,
yeah.
Fauci said. That was part of the clip. And that's been true at the federal level. It was true with Mayor de Blasio, New York liberal, who is reluctant to close schools, reluctant to cancel the St. Patrick's Day parade out of economic inequality concerns, and lots of people. So to your point about how Trump is going to be judged on how we reopen, here's another Fauci clip from CNN State of the Union yesterday about how to reopen the country.
It is not going to be a light switch that we say, okay, it is now June, July, or whatever, click, the light switch goes back on. It's going to be depending where you are in the country, the nature of the outbreak that you've already experienced, and the threat of an outbreak that you may not have experienced. So it's going to having to look at the situation in different parts of the country. Obviously, New York, who went and is going through a terrible ordeal, is going to be very different from Arkansas, and very different maybe from some places on the West Coast, like Washington State, which have been successfully able to prevent that big spike. I think it's going to have to be something that is not one size fits all.
So that's actually very consistent with the president's vision, too, I think, Tom, taking it place by place rather than nationally or nothing at all.
Yeah, there's no question, and I agree with you, Brian. He was not throwing Trump under the bus. He was actually trying to carefully, you know, tiptoe down the middle of that question, because it is undeniable. Had we taken action earlier, it would have been better, but taking action earlier at that time would have been obviously politically challenging. So that's all he was really saying. Look, we are going to have to go back to work in the context of uncertainty and the virus still circulating in our society, because you only get immunity from the virus from a vaccine or from herd immunity, where 60 to 70% of us get it, and maybe 1% more die. And we're trying to avoid that solution, which is probably the only solution for many developing countries, by this approach of suppress, mitigate, and then phase open up on a kind of risk stratified basis, who's the most vulnerable, who's the least vulnerable. But it's going to be challenging. And what Trump should be doing right now, imagine, Brian, we had a real president. Here's how the daily briefing would go if we had a real president. There would be three charts in front of the room. The first chart would be how many people have the virus, how many people died last night, and where are we in terms of getting the medical supplies, the pharmaceuticals, and protective gear and ventilators to every hospital that needs them that's seeing a spike now in the country. It'd be a map of the country. Here's the supplies. Here's the challenge. Here's the spike. Here's where we are today. Second graph would be who is succeeding in suppressing the virus and bending the curve, who hasn't. All 50 states, here's where it's working, here's where it's not. What can we learn from this chart? Third graph would be where are we on getting in place the testing, tracing, tracking, surveillance technology we need to the places that are now suppressing the virus in order to open up. Same thing, here's where it's 50 states, here's where it's doing well, who's not. And every day, the president or the vice president or Dr. Fauci would come out and say, this is clearly our plan. Save as many people as we can now. Try to bend the curve and try to pivot. And every day they'd come out and say, here's where we are on these three indices. Instead, we have a president who's freelancing and BSing. He comes out and he'll say, we got 100,000 ventilators somewhere today. And it's like completely out of context. It's not connected to a plan. It's not connected to a defined set of metrics, which he defined in the beginning as part of a plan. And so you watch these briefings. The idea that he went on for 2.5 hours is pornographic, to think that the President of the United States spent 2.5 hours indulging himself in this briefing without a plan, without a clear set of metrics. And so I watch those briefings, and they leave me more anxious, more ill at ease, because you don't feel a plan, and you feel a guy who's basically performing and satisfying his own ego.
Let me play one more clip to that point. At the Friday Trump team news conference, he got into it with CNN's Jim Acosta when Acosta asked about what some see as happy talk by Trump. That phrase was in Acosta's question. Happy talk by Trump, as some see it, about how supplied we are, in particular, with the necessary tools compared to the real situation. Here's part of that exchange as Acosta asks this.
If you look at some of these questions, do we have enough masks? No. Do we have enough tests? No. Do we have enough PPE? No.
Why would you say no?
Do we have enough medical
equipment?
The answer
is yes. I think the answer is yes. Who said no to that?
I'm saying this.
No, you're saying no. But who said no? But you asked me, do we have enough masks? Yes.
We hear from doctors. We hear from
health
experts.
No, you didn't say that. You said, do we have enough masks?
Does the country?
Yes. Do we have enough tests? Yes. Plus, we're developing new tests. Do we have enough ventilators? Yes.
So, Tom Friedman, New York Times columnist, do we have enough masks? No, obviously. We get calls every day from healthcare workers who are having to reuse their masks. Do we have enough tests? Well, we know that's maybe the biggest impediment to reopening the country is the ability to do that massive population testing and contact tracing that would allow people to return safely. He's just lying.
Yeah, he's just a BSer, and I'd use the specific term if I could. You know, that's all he is. That's how he got through life, you know, BSing his bankers and BSing on TV, and that's who he is. He's you know, Brian, we all warned for 3 years, hey, we haven't had a crisis yet. You know, what'll happen if we have a crisis? Who thought that the crisis we'd have is actually a once-in-a-century pandemic, the worst kind of crisis for someone who has so many acting secretaries because he hasn't filled positions, who has the attention span of a two-year-old, and who is obsessed with his own ego. And you know, I really tried in my own column not to write about Trump because I find it's just wasted breath and to focus on the big questions. But it's hard to get you know, around the fact that we can only that having a president with these habits, these tendencies, is a real liability. But thank God we have 50 states and 50 governors and mayors, and some of them have really shined in this crisis.
And I'll read one tweet that's representative of a number of tweets that are coming in. Please ask Tom Friedman why Dems would include Republicans in a cabinet. Dems are angry, and Republicans have shown zero ability to compromise or govern. How about Biden include Republicans if Republicans give back a Supreme Court seat and end the challenge to the Affordable Care Act? But on the premise, never mind those particular deal points, which, you know, he's making a point with them, but that Democrats are angry and Republicans have shown zero ability to compromise or govern, why go for the unity government rather than a good, solid Democratic government and go out and try to win with that?
It's a perfectly legitimate question. And, you know, just as in 2008, it fell to Barack Obama, who, by the way, appointed a Republican, Chuck Hagel, as his defense secretary, to clean up the mess of George W. Bush. It's going to fall to Democrats to clean up the mess of Donald Trump. And and I share that resentment. But I think that for Democrats to be the most effective in doing that, because I think the strains around these questions of equity and civil liberties, among others, are going to be so great that insulating themselves by having some Republican representation in the cabinet, I think is actually smart politics, and also a way to, again, as I said, to win the election. But the behavior of Mitch McConnell, I think Mitch McConnell will go down as one of the worst people in America. I think that the Murdoch family, for the denialism on climate and the early denialism on this epidemic that they manifested on Fox News, there will be a reckoning with history for them. Right now, I'm so concerned about my country and how we get out of this that I'm just focused on how I thought is the most effective way to approach this.
So last thing, well, two things, really. Call it a two-part question. One, your column has been out for 6 days now. I'm curious if you've gotten any response from the Biden campaign. And related to that, you probably saw Biden has an op-ed in the Times today called My Plan to Safely Reopen America. And to my eye, on first reading, it's not really any different than Trump's plan. Maybe he's trying to put it out with more credibility or gravitas, but if you get past the Trump part of the Trump news conferences and listen to Dr. Fauci and listen to Dr. Birx and listen even to the vice president, I think it's not so different from this. Here's the Biden plan in short. I'm reading a few lines from his op-ed. First, we have to get the number of new cases of the disease down significantly. That means social distancing has to continue. Second, there needs to be widespread, easily available, and prompt testing and contact tracing. Third, we have to make sure that our hospitals and healthcare system are ready for flare-ups of the disease. And once we've taken these steps, we can begin to reopen more businesses and put more people back to work. Things will not go back to normal right away. As public health experts have said, we should expect activity to return gradually. So I'm reading this and I'm thinking, that's what everybody's saying. So is Joe Biden distinguishing himself from Trump when he does talk?
It's a really good question, Brian, and that's kind of what I was getting into. It's very hard in a crisis like this to demonstrate leadership, especially when you, as the alternative candidate, have to shelter in place and may have to for a long time because of he's in that most vulnerable cohort. So that's really what I was trying to get at in this column. I think there's two ways that Biden could demonstrate leadership given the strictures he's under. One is by approaching it in a much more national unity bent and and leaning into that. And the second is, if I were Biden, I'd be doing a 30-minute, just very concise, trolling Trump update every day at the exact same time that he does it, and challenge the CNN, MSNBC, the cable networks, actually to do a split screen of his briefing and Trump's briefing, do it with those kind of three graphs I did. You could do it very economically, and show how a real president would actually be daily briefing and navigating this crisis.
And have they nibbled?
I've not heard from them at all.
New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, his latest column suggests that Joe Biden name a unity cabinet now, with all kinds of well-known and qualified people from both parties. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Brian, call anytime, and stay safe and well, and to all your listeners, thanks so much.
And you too. Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.